for Burgess. Good flick. This is a Wusu! And a very good save by Cutler.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello, Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
How are we?
Sprightly today. Very sprightly. Looking forward to this one. This has been one that we've been waiting on near enough since day dot. Like, it was one of the, or certainly a contact that we know very well and someone that is a friend of the show, listens to the show quite regularly. And we've been saying for such a long time, we'll get him on any day now. We've had a couple of times where we've tried, hasn't quite worked out for whatever reason, but finally we've got him, pinned him down. He can't escape. We have got him.
Sounds quite brutal. That made quite sinister.
A little aggressive. I mean, to be honest, if I did try and pin him down, I don't think he would
stay
down. He's a big guy. He's a big guy. He's very incredibly strong, actually. Does a lot of cycling. We didn't really talk about that, actually, in the pod that you're about to listen to. But a very, very keen and strong cyclist.
Lovely stuff. Shall we get on with it?
Let's do it.
This week's guest is a goalkeeper placed among the pantheon of top goalkeeper coaches in English football. As a player, he started with the Baggies before bagging a promotion with the Potters, EFL survival with the Swans, and a top flight flirt with Aston Villa. And it is at Villa Park where he has returned as goalkeeper coach to the likes of, among others, Tom Heaton, Pepe Reina, Jed Steer, and of course, Emi Martinez. Neil Cutler, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Morning, guys. How are we doing?
Good, thank you. Great to have you on, isn't it, Rich?
It is indeed. It's been a long time coming. It's been a long time coming. And we've already had this conversation off air that we're not happy with cuts, given that he has done the Ben Foster podcast before he's done our podcast. So, I mean, look, we have to take some of the blame, given that we must have organized this about 10 times and just never actually quite worked. There was once, actually, do you know what I remember? We were very, very close to doing it where you were with Pepe Reina, weren't you? And there was going to And that didn't quite materialize, unfortunately. But look, you're here now, and I'm actually very, very excited about this. Is it for me to kick this off, Matt?
Three questions, Rich, haven't we? Come on.
Ah, we do indeed. And how do I always forget these, given that I've done this hundreds of times? But look, I remember one of them. What is your favorite shirt that you ever had as a player? What was your favorite playing shirt?
I think that was my Stoke promotion shirt. Obviously, it was my best run as a player, so that's the top I remember fondly. You know, we got promoted that season, and you know, when you're comfortable in a strip, when you're comfortable in a strip, you feel good, you play good, and it was just one of them strips where I actually enjoyed wearing. It was when you wear strips as a player, you know, if you didn't feel right, really, like, you know, especially being tall like me, if the shorts were too small and I didn't feel quite right in them, I didn't enjoy that. So got to a good club in Stoke and got a good run of games and got promoted, and the strip was really good. So we'll have that.
Nice. Do you know what? We could go into a lot of detail on that, because I've certainly had a very similar experience. One of the other questions is, what was the best save that you ever made? Not necessarily the one that people will remember you for, but from your point of view, the best save that you made.
I think the most important one was, it was a playoff. It was that year, actually. It was a playoff semi-final, and we were losing. We were playing Cardiff at home in the first leg, and we were losing 2-1. And it was a one-on-one with Robert Earnshaw. And literally, we'd have been dead and buried if we scored it. And I managed to save the one-on-one and took it into the second leg. And we fortunately won the second leg. So in terms of importance, that was a huge, huge save. And obviously went on to get promoted. So that would be the save that sticks in my mind.
Beautiful. Love it. And the last question, I've done these in completely the wrong order, and I can see Matt looking at
butchered
me.
Butchered it. He's absolutely butchered it again.
Look, I've got around, as long as the three,
How many times, mate?
You're very good at this. You can just make it sound seamless. So I'm sure it'll be absolutely fine. The other question was, of course, brand of gloves. What brand of gloves did you wear when you played? And what were your favourite pair of gloves?
I wore Sells for years, to be fair. They really looked after me. And then when I finished, I wear two toes now, and two toes really, really look after me and really pleased with them. But playing, I always wore Sells, really comfortable, really looked after me. So, growing up, I always wore Sells, and I was a big one into wristbands. When I played, wristband had to be really tight. So if a pair of gloves didn't have a strong wristband, I struggled with them. So Sells always had that real strong wristband that I could really pull tight. So they're the ones I've wore for years, really.
How do you feel about that now with the wristband and the fact that the gloves, a lot of them don't actually have the wristband, right? They're just the slip-ons.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was just a habit with me. I'd always play with it and mess with it and pull it tight. And I think it was just a bit of a habit. But it's changed now, isn't it? They wear thinner gloves. Obviously, there's far more fit, different fits. So yeah, I don't think, if I played now, I don't think I'd be as bothered. I don't think I'd be as concerned with it all. But at the time, it was like, well, I had to be tight, I had to be a certain player, I had to be all right. But yeah, there's so many different fits and so many different pairs of gloves out now that, you know, you can change and find the right one for you. But at the time when I was playing, there wasn't that many different fits. So I mainly went with the ones that were really strong around the wrist. And obviously the palm of cells were always really good, always grippy. So they're the ones I went for.
It was the old wrapper, wasn't it? That was the one that I used to love. It was the roll finger, like white, yeah, classic looking glove.
Yeah, standard. But you see, a lot of doctors wore them at the time, didn't they? That were the main gloves. Mm. The main gloves were obviously the cells. And quite a few goalkeepers at the time were wearing them. And yeah, they were just really comfortable, really grippy. So
you mentioned the gloves that you wear now. Might be a stupid question, but how important is it for the gloves that you wear now as a goalkeeper coach compared to when you were a player? Is it important to have top quality gloves?
Not really, no. Not really. I like to feel like I always wear gloves. You get coaches now that don't wear gloves. But I don't feel right unless I'm wearing gloves. I don't feel part of it. I don't feel like I like to feel right when I'm coaching. And I don't feel right if I haven't got gloves on. I don't feel part of it. I don't feel like I'm part of the group. So I always like to wear gloves. You know, it's different goalkeeper coaches have different ideas, different thoughts, but I prefer to wear them. I prefer to be part of it, especially when you're doing a lot of serving. I make sure that I've got my gloves on. I may take them off. After we've done the goalkeeping work, I'll take them off. It's weird, really. It's just how you feel, isn't it? So if I'm working with the goalies, I keep them on to feel part of it, to feel part of the group. And then when I'm not working with the goalkeepers in terms of a specific goalkeeping session and they go over the outfield players, I'll take them off. Because then I'm more of an outfield coach and I'm coaching them, you know, within a group of players. So I feel more like I'm integrating into the outfield kind of coach's work. So it's just how you feel. It's just a different feel. And I don't want to be, when I'm walking over and I'm working with the goalkeepers in a match-specific scenario, I want to feel like I'm integrating into the group of coaches rather than just a specific goalkeeping coach. So I'll take them off. And it's just that feel. It's just how you feel.
Do you know, we could do a whole pod on like glove habits, Matt, at some point, because every goalkeeper has different. So my one was always obviously wearing the gloves after training, always take them in the shower with me. So they'd be washed in the shower, then hung up. And I'd always make sure I hung them up somewhere where the sun couldn't get to them. So it'd have to be, sometimes that wasn't on my peg because the sun would come in the window and I'd always worry that the sun would get to them. So I'd have to put them in a certain place in the changing room. And then even the day after, I might have two or three pairs and I would test all two, three pairs before training, which one's got the best grip for that particular day. But like, you actually think of the detail that you go into, and every goalkeeper's the same, like the pride that you take in your pair of gloves.
Oh, Rich, it's different. I'm having to educate the goalies on how to wash their gloves because they get that many pairs. Honestly, they'll come in and be like a new pair every other day. And you're like, you've got to look after your gloves better. Get in the shower, get them washed, get them clean, get them hung up, really look after them. And it's like, you have to educate them. It's crazy.
Do you know the one that got me was when I was at Blackburn, Brad Friedel. So he would always wear a brand new pair for every game and pretty much a brand new pair for training a lot of days. He got through hundreds of pairs a season. But he would go into a game with a brand new pair, wouldn't wash them anything. Where for me, that was a big thing. Like, I'd have to wash the gloves a couple of times at least before playing a game in them.
Yeah, 100%. And Emmy's quite similar. Emmy will have hundreds and hundreds of pairs of gloves and he'll just keep coming out with new pairs. And it's how you feel, isn't it? You know, like if you feel like you need a new pair of gloves for every training session, every other training session, every game, then you do it. Especially at our level, if it gives you that extra edge, then do it. Jed will wear gloves. Jed Steele will wear gloves over and over and over and over again. But his hands are that good. Yeah, I don't think it bothers him. What he's wearing, he could wear gardening gloves and still catch it. But he's an absolute nightmare because he puts Vaseline on them. So we all have to cover his gloves in Vaseline, right? And I'm trying to serve it. So as I'm throwing it up, sticking to the Vaseline, I end up chasing the ball left, right, and centre trying to serve it. absolute nightmare, isn't he? Like, oh, yeah, sorry about that. I'm like, Jesus, it's difficult. But he finds, you know, he'll wear old gloves, but he'll layer them in Vaseline, and he finds that helps, especially in wetter weather. I think Joe Hart was the first one to come out with that.
I was going to say, that baffled me. When I first heard that, you're looking a bit confused, mate. You might not have heard this. So Vaseline on gloves that are dying, suddenly they become very, very good again. And it almost goes against logic. You'd think, if anything, of course, putting a greasy substance on your glove isn't going to... But it does. It just brings them back to life for a few more sessions. Yeah, mental.
Yeah.
So actually, what tips then, just to finish the glove chat to begin with, what tips would you give? Because I guess there is a difference for some people. Some people clean their gloves in a different way. But if you were to speak to your goalkeepers now, Cuts, and say, right, this is how I want you to look after your gloves, what would you say?
Well, to start with, you know, like, you, if you're not cleaning your gloves, you look sloppy, you look unorganized. And as a goalkeeper, you want to be organized. You want to be switched on. You don't want to look like you're not detailed and look like you're not taking care of your stuff. So you have to make sure you're wearing clean gloves. Get them in the shower. Don't use soap, just water. And then rinse them off and then hang them up. But don't put them in the washing machine. The worst thing you can do is put gloves in the washing machine. Dries them all out and takes all the good liquids out of them. So just get, as soon as you finish training, get them in the shower, get them nice and clean, and then you're ready for the next training session. And you look clean, you look organized, you look like you're ready to go. But dirty boots and dirty gloves is definitely a no-go.
Do you know what? I love that we've started this pod this way, because I often joke that if you were to join a group of goalkeepers for dinner, we would speak about gloves all evening. And we've actually spent the first 10 minutes of this podcast going into real detail about goalkeeper gloves. I love that we've started it this way. And actually, I do, yeah, obviously delighted to have you on, Cuts, because I think it's a conversation we've wanted to have for a long, long time. I know we speak a lot privately, and certainly when I talk about goalkeeper coaches and a rise to the top, you know, fantastic example as to what you've done, where you've been, the way in which you've gone from obviously Walsall and then various clubs since then in order to be where you're currently at. And must say, at time of recording, obviously an interesting time for Aston Villa. Dean Smith just leaving, Steven Gerrard just being announced. So, of course, the goalkeeper coach's role through a transition like that. We'll certainly like to touch on that. But there's so much that I want to get into. We don't want to repeat too much of what was discussed in the Ben podcast, of course, but we've all sorts of questions we want to pose. And I know, Matt, you want to take it down a very slightly different route, if possible.
Well, different as such. I thought, actually, we'd go a little bit left field to begin with, because am I right in thinking, Cuts, that you were a product of Lillishaw?
Yeah. Went to Lillishaw when I was, I think, 15. I just turned 15 when I went to Lillishaw, yeah, for 2 years.
So this fascinates me. I think Lillishaw fascinates me because at the time that we were growing up, I know Rich and I, Rich, obviously you were a pro, but I used to go to those soccer schools at Bisham Abbey, and everybody would always talk about Lillishaw and just how incredible this magical place of Lillishaw was. So it was the best, 15, 16 players in the country that got picked to play at Lillishaw between the ages of 14, 16. Michael Owen, Sol Campbell, Andy Cole, all of those kinds of names. But you were there, so you got picked. So you were effectively, at that time, regarded as the best goalkeeper in the country for your age.
Yeah, you go through a series of trials. And I can remember kept going back to Lillishaw, having all these trials, and you get whittled down and whittled down and whittled down from hundreds of kids to the final 16. And at the time, it was just enormous for me. You know, like, I think before, I'd just gone 15 when I got in. I'm pretty much a homeboy, you know, settled in school, settled with my friends, and to be taken away with that, it was just like a massive upheaval. It was just a huge thing for me and my family. But, you know, what a place in terms of experience, just huge.
So how can you describe it? Because it did sound like this magical place. Because you went to, did you go to school there as well?
Yeah.
You boarded there?
Yeah. Went to Idsel School in Shifnal. But like, you go there basically, and it's like you're there 24/7. You're there. You know you're going to be there for 2 years, and it's just a massive learning experience. You've got family there that look after you. You've got all your meals, all your food, and it's just basically it's teaching you how to be a professional footballer from such a young age. You know, it's like being a day-to-day professional footballer at the age of 14, 15. And it just prepares you. It prepares you for life as a footballer. Obviously, it didn't work out because all these teams now have got their academies, and they're being taught from such a young age now that, you know, you don't need a Lily Shaw. You're getting taught that from the ages of 7, 8, and 9 anyway. So, but the way we prepared, we travelled all over Europe. We played games against the best teams in the world. With the best coaches. I mean, at the time, I was getting coached by the best goalkeeping coaches around, and that we were getting what, 5-6 days a week, just every night after school. We'd instead of doing PE, we'd stay at Lily Shaw and be coached. We played against academy teams at the weekend, so we'd play against your Liverpools and your Evertons, and at the weekend, we'd travel and watch a game. So we might go to a Villa game. We might go to, you know, like Everton. But every weekend, we'd travel to watch a game. You know, so what we learned over that 2-year period was huge, absolutely massive, and it just prepares you for life as a footballer really, really well. The only issue I found is that when I left Lily Shaw was that I went from Lily Shaw to West Brom, and I didn't have the same. It was kind of like, the training ground was really poor. The pitches were really poor. And I was given the best for 2 years. And all of a sudden, I was thrown into a scenario where West Brom didn't have the same things that Lily Shaw had. They didn't have the top pitches. You know, you weren't treated the same. And I kind of struggled for a little bit to deal with that. I was thrown into a first-team environment from a kid's environment where you're treated totally different. And Rich, obviously, you'll have all these experiences when you're a kid growing up. When we were kids, you know, you weren't treated like a young international footballer like they are now. Just thrown into the environment where all of a sudden you've got to be up there ready to play in the first team. You've got to be ready to go. And I wasn't. I was probably 6'4", 6'3", 6'4" at the time. Probably looked physically like I was getting there, but mentally I was nowhere near it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? It's interesting. I want to touch on that because you mentioned you went from that to, and it's a completely different mentality, it feels like, now at most clubs. In that there was, I remember my early days at Watford and some of the things you would do, it was kind of branded as trying to toughen you up a little bit, but I don't think it necessarily had the desired impact. But the fact you mentioned you were at Lily Shaw for a couple of years and you had those experiences, I can imagine that now as a coach, doing what you do, as much as you'll have learned doing the various badges and on the various courses that you've gone on, so much of it, of course, will have been from your own experiences. So going through that at such an early age, and I'm guessing seeing the development that you had during that period of time, how much of that plays a part in terms of what you do now?
It's absolutely massive, you know, and a lot of it is psychological. I know we spoke a lot about the psych side of it, and a lot of it, so much of it is psychological. If I'd have... Now, coming from Lily Shaw and having all experiences and all that knowledge, and I was technically very good when I left Lily Shaw. Psychologically, coming into West Brom, I was miles off it, absolutely miles off it. And if I'd have had a goalkeeping coach that could have helped me through that, that could have continued my journey from where I was at and then pushed me in slowly towards the first team environment, I'd have been flying, and I just didn't have anybody. I was just thrown into the first team environment. I was miles off it. I was still a baby, really, psychologically. So the experiences I've had from that, you know, it's not technical and it's not tactical. From young goalkeepers, it's how you treat them. It's the relationships you have with them. It's knowing all about them. It's integrating them into the first team environment slowly, like we do now. It's the perfect scenario for young goalkeepers to come into our environment from a young age, to be able to be with the first team, to integrate them into that environment, but slowly, and be there with them and be there for them, you know, and drip them in and drip them out. And it's to someone like, we've got a 17-year-old Ollie Zitch that comes into our, he's just gone 17, right? And at times he's like a rabbit in the headlights, but if you explain to him, that's how it's going to be. You don't have to worry about that. You're going to concede goals. You're going to give the ball away. It's a million mile an hour. But I never had that. So he'd have like the players moaning at him because they want to win and they're winners, you know, and they're so driven and they're so competitive. But if he lets a goal in or gives the ball away, you know, it's like, Rich, they're straight on you. Come on, it'll be better. And sometimes that can send the goalkeeper under. But if you've got the right environment and if you understand the psychological side of it, you know, he knows you're there with him and you're there for him. So you can go, come on, that's all right. That's fine. Cause that's going to happen. That's part of your development. Don't worry about that. Keep trying to play that ball through, you know, keep risking it if you want to, but that's how you learn, through your mistakes. And that's how you're going to develop. And, you know, as kids, we never had that, did we? We never had that somebody to go, you know, just relax and play. Just relax and play. Keep doing it. Keep working on, you know, everything we're working on, because they're all going through conscious phases. They're all having to think about what they're doing. It's not, they're not in a scenario yet where they can, where it all comes naturally. It's all thought based. So they're having to come in with me and think. They're having to go in with the first team and think. You know, it's like loads of things. I've got to think about my hands. I've got to think about my position. I've got to think about, you know, I'm not rotating. I'm not going back. My biomechanics are right. You know, there's loads of things to think about. And if you keep telling them, you know, that's, you're having to do that. That is part of your development. You think until you don't have to think. It becomes natural. And if they know that that's part of their development and that's the environment you're creating, then they develop so much quicker.
Mm. Do you know what? It's the four stages of learning, isn't it? Where you then get to the level of unconscious competence, where I always give the example of driving a car. Well, when you first learn to drive, the first few weeks, all you're doing is thinking about everything and the amount of near crashes you have, just because it doesn't feel that natural. But of course, before you know it, you set off, you get to your destination, you haven't even thought as to how you've got there. And that's, I guess, a lot of, and I love the fact we got onto this so quickly. And I was going to bring this up anyway, obviously knowing you as I do and having seen your rise and knowing how you operate. The fact that goalkeeper coaching, the technical part obviously is important, but I will always harp on about the relationship side of things, because most goalkeepers, in fact, I'd say all goalkeepers, I like the idea that everybody does what they do with the best of intentions. You know, there's very few young goalkeepers out there that don't want to reach the top. They'll want to reach the top, but it can be very easy to brand a goalkeeper lazy, or they just don't want it enough, and whatever else. The truth is, and I think we all know this, is that of course they do, but then maybe their behaviours aren't necessarily showing that. So how big is it for you to effectively find a way to unlock that by building that relationship, that trusting relationship, where you can find out who they are? You're doing it according to them in order to bring out the best of them.
I think it's absolutely huge. And you've got to remember that not everybody's the same. They're all different. We're all made up a different way, psychologically especially. You'll have ones that just fit in and go. You know, like we've got goalkeepers like Viljami Sinisalo, Philip Marshall, that just go to the environment and just fit in really well. And you can see that they keep stepping forward. You know, they won't step backwards or keep stepping forward. But you've got to find out everything about them, how they tick, you know, what, especially like with your first team goalies. So with Emmy, I know absolutely everything about him. I have to. And Jed, I know everything about him. I know anything about Emmy's family. I know exactly what he's doing, where he lives, his kids, his wife, you know, what he does at the weekend, his family. Recently, unfortunately, his dad had a huge heart attack back in Argentina. So he rang me. He felt comfortable enough to ring me and text me in the night to tell me. First thing in the morning, I shot straight around his house, making sure he's all right, his family are okay, and to plan for him to go back to Argentina, because I know how close he is with his dad and I know how close he is with his family. And just to make sure that he knew that he could go back to Argentina. There's no stress, to take the stress away from him, you know, and just to be there for him, you know. And he needs to know that I'm there for him no matter what, because it's not me telling him what to do in order for him to get better. It's for us to have a relationship where we can make him better, where he bounces things off me and I bounce things off him, and that's how you learn. You can't just go into sessions going, this is what you do. You've got to do this. This is my philosophy. You've got to do it this way, else I'll get somebody else in that will. Because basically all you're working on with these top goalkeepers is changing little tiny details in order to make them better, you know, to keep improving them. And in order to do that, you have to have a relationship. You have to have that relationship where they're comfortable going, no, I don't believe that. I don't think that's right. What do you think about that? And then you have the discussion, you look back at it, and then you decide which is the best way forward from there. And little details, tiny little details. And Jed Steer has been unbelievable at that, in terms of the tiny details. He's so consistent day in, day out, because he just takes things on board and he just keeps doing it. were really good in discussions, you know. And as I spoke before, it's not just it's creating that environment where they're free to do that. You know, creating an environment is huge, you know, where they come in every day and they know they're going to learn. They're not just ticking a box and going. They know every goalkeeper there knows, even if they're not playing, they know that I care about their development. I care about how they're developing, not only technical, tactical, but hugely psychological. You know, I care that Jed Steer, you know, is not playing. And my job is to get him into the team. My job is to get him into our first team and be ready. My job is to keep Emmy in the first team and not come out of the first team. That's my job. You know, I have to keep them developing. And they know that because you create the environment that they know they're learning. I remember last year where we'd have four first team goalies. You know, they all wanted to play. They all thought they were ready to play, which they were. So if you don't create an environment where they know they're learning, if you don't create an environment where they're coming in and developing, you lose them. You just lose them because they're not playing, and they were all international goalies. They're all, you know, first team goalies in their own right. If they come into the environment and they know they're getting better, they're still going to keep buying into it. They're still going to come in with energy and life, and that's the kind of environment you want to keep. And it is psychological. It's knowing them. It's knowing how they work and how they tick individually because they're different.
I love that. And again, you keep using that word environment. And there's a couple of things here I've written down as you were talking there. One is the simplicity, actually, of what you're saying, and that in theory, this is something that you would think, and again, a lot of coaches listening in, obviously a lot of goalkeepers listening in, a lot of what you're saying, it makes logical sense in that if you can build that and it is more focused on the process as opposed to the result. Of course, you want the result to be right and you need the good performances, otherwise things can change. But ultimately, from your point of view, it is all process driven. I'm going to throw a scenario at you because this will be one that I'm sure that every goalkeeper and coach has experienced in that, let's say you have a game on the Saturday and your goalkeeper, a goal goes in. You go into the manager's change room, the manager's slaughtering the goalkeeper, got to do better with that, et cetera, and he's kind of saying it to you. You're then talking to the goalkeeper who doesn't necessarily feel that he was at fault. You're effectively now the middleman between the manager and the goalkeeper. How do you handle that situation?
Well, if you see, and you'll know this, every goal that goes in, you can do something better. That, you know, you can break it down, you can go, I should have done this, I should have been there, I should have done this. And in terms of the manager, you have to educate them in terms of, you can't just go, yeah, okay, and walk off. You have to educate them in the reasons. So it'll be whatever it may be, you have to say, yeah, I've assessed it, I've looked at it, and it's because of these reasons, right? He's done this, 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 and this, and this is what we'll be doing. We'll be working on it. And it only really becomes an issue if he continues to make the same mistake, because goalkeepers make mistakes. They're not always good. They're not going to do the right thing constantly. Like, you're going to make a mistake now and again. A ball's going to go in. There's always something you can do better, right? So it's the manager trusting and understanding you, that you know exactly what's going on and you're going to put it right. You know, that relationship where, you know, I know what he trusts, that I know what I'm doing, and he knows I'm going to do that. I'm going to work on it with the goalkeeper. Now, in terms of the goalkeeper, see, if I'm working with Emi Martinez, it's the other way around with him. So I have to kind of, he'll know he's made a mistake and he'll be already trying to put it right during the game. So he'll be like, he'll come in at halftime and go, oh, I could have done this. And I was out of position. I'm like, whoa. Forget about that. You're not even talking about that. You know, we're not working on that now. Now we're working on psychological. Now we're working on you being front foot, your communication, you're moving with the ball to keep you switched on, to not focus on what's just happened. And he's really good with that, but he's so driven and so motivated and so wanting to do well that he gets caught up in that, you know, I should have saved it, I should have done this, and should have, whoa. Now we deal with that Monday, right? So I don't speak to him about mistakes after the game. I don't speak to him about hardly anything after the game, because you're so caught up in the moment that you're not going to talk sense anyway. So I leave him, totally leave him alone. I may say a couple of things, you know, you did this well, you did that well, and we'll talk about what the other thing on Monday. Leave him be at the weekend, let him have the weekend off, and then Monday we'll have a debrief and chat about what's gone on. And debriefs are such a great tool. And we go back to the Fozcast. Fozzy was really good, you know, in terms of when I went there, I got all the goalkeepers in and we all sat down and did a debrief to watch, you know, what Ben did at games, just gain that experience of, you know, what how he dealt with games. And Emi would, I could do exactly the same with Emi because he's so passionate and so like wanting to learn that he would be exactly the same. And he we'll sit through every single clip. And a lot of people go, we sit through every clip. That's boring. But I don't talk through every clip. So I'll just put it on and me and the analyst and Emi will sit there and it'll be all his clips. And I might jump in or I'll just wait for him to talk. And he might go, well, if he'd done that, I could have played that through there and he could have bounced. Right, okay. And then we might have a discussion and it's clipped on. And it's more of a discussion than, you know, why haven't you done this? Why haven't you done that? It's more of a, what do you see? You know, what have you seen there? What from your vision? It's easy from, especially the cameras we've got at Villa Park, you're slightly out of position. You know, why you're out of position there? It's easy to say that. If you go, okay, what are you seeing? We say, well, you know, the body's in front. I've had to change my position slightly to accommodate. You know, I can't see the ball. I've had to change it. Right, okay, well, same scenario pops up again. What are we going to do? And then we can recreate that in training and put it right. And like I say, he's so motivated to improve. He's so motivated to be the best that you're not having to push him. You're just having to guide him. And he guides himself. You know, he's guiding himself down the right corridors because he's so willing to improve and so willing to be the best. It's such an easy environment to be in that, you know, he's pushing himself to be the best, which is just brilliant.
Do you know what? It's that, and I guess you've gone such detail there, but it is that learning environment. I suppose if you are sat around, see, one of the biggest things for me is the ability to detach your game from you, the person. Like, how many goalkeepers are out there that when they're told they make a mistake, they almost take it personally? And if they don't feel comfortable, they don't have the trust with the goalkeeper coach, then they're not necessarily going to be so open in order to admit that maybe they could have done more. So I wanted to mention that because I think I love that you're almost all looking at the footage and you're all giving ideas. You're almost looking at it like it's not you, it's somebody else. And you're just like, look, judge this, give your thought. I love that. I think, so the idea of that.
The manager's not going to be as 100%, like the knowledge of goalkeeping for a manager is not going to be as in-depth as us. So when it comes out with this, you should have done better, you should have done this, you should have done that. You've got to take it as it is, right? You've got to take it, right, okay, he thinks I should have done better. But, you know, then the manager's knowledge of goalkeeping is totally different to ours. So he's got to trust the process that we are going to now discuss this and go into detail of it, and it might not be his fault. So I can discuss with the manager. If the manager trusts me, I can go, well, if you look at this and that, look at the way he's rotated in front of him in the last minute and he can't see it, or it's gone through his legs, or, you know, like little details, or it's skipped up, or taken a little deflection, or wherever it may be. But, you know, it's trusting the process that it's not always a given that it's your fault. You know, you can always, like I say, always do something different with a goal. And there's always something that's, you know, caused the problem. So it's that detail, isn't it, of the psychological strength of knowing, okay, he thinks it's my fault, but we're going to deal with it.
Well, it's been an eminently forgettable night for Middlesbrough. It's a night to remember for this young man, Neil Cutler, who's been on the bench for the last 13 games for Aston Villa, finally gets on the field. The ex-England youth international who was signed from Chester in November. He's a substitute because Peter Enkelman, who's the normal number two standing for David James, is out injured. So Neil Cutler has got 7 minutes of his Premiership debut.
Something we've spoke about a lot in the last couple of years is the idea of creating almost a goalkeeper coaches union, you know, so that coaches can get together. Because you've spoke a lot there about the relationship with the manager. Now, there'll be a lot of coaches listening in saying, oh, well, that's fine. You've got Dean Smith, who you're tight with, and you've cultivated that relationship. You know, my manager is such and such. There's a few managers out there that we all know that maybe aren't the most pleasant towards goalkeepers, maybe don't fully understand. So how do you then cultivate that relationship if the manager isn't necessarily open in the way that I'm assuming Dean Smith obviously was, and hopefully Steven Gerrard will be for you moving forward, because that's key. Everything you've said there is absolutely key in order to then feed that information back and forth. And actually, the big one for me, and I've said this several times on the podcast, and a lot of what you've just said there, by the way, is the whole reason we even do this podcast. But I've said it several times where I find that managers that don't necessarily respect goalkeepers often have underperforming goalkeepers, or seemingly underperforming goalkeepers. Whereas, not just saying that you're on the pod, but I think it's fair to say that your goalkeepers and the goalkeepers you've worked with over the last 5-10 years plus have always been key performers and very consistent performers. How much of that comes down to that relationship with the manager, and how do you cultivate that if you haven't necessarily got a manager like a Dean Smith who is perhaps maybe that little bit more open?
Yeah, I did a Q&A with the A-licence candidates a few weeks ago, A-licence coaches, and I spoke about it briefly about relationships with managers are so, so important, and it has been easy for me with Dean Smith because he's so open and he trusts me. But I have been with other managers, you know, where if they don't quite get it, you have to keep drip feeding. What you can't do is going, I didn't get it, so I'm not going to bother. You know, I'm just going to do my bit in the corner over there where the goal is, you know, and then go home. Because what you then have to do, you know, if you want to improve, if you want your goalkeeper to be the best they possibly can be, you have to drip feed them information, whether they want to listen to it or not. You have to drip feed them detail about what's going on. And once you keep drip feeding and drip feeding and drip feeding, all of a sudden it clicks and they go, hang on. He knows what he's talking about. You know, he's driven to improve them. You can't knock that. You can't knock hard work and desire and detail. You just can't knock it. What you can knock is someone going, well, I'm going to stand in the corner. I'm not getting on with the manager. So I'm going to get in, get my work done, go home, and then come back tomorrow and tick another box. Can't do that. You gain your relationship through knowledge. And again, creating an environment where, you know, you're all about learning, you're all about developing, you're all about desire, you're all about, you know, loving the position, loving the game. And managers can't knock that. You just can't knock it. It's impossible. And especially if you've got a manager who's got anything about them, they want to win games, you know. They want to win games. They want to move forward. They want to be better. They want to improve, you know. And if you're giving them that kind of knowledge and that kind of desire and that kind of work ethic, eventually it's going to click and they're going to go, oh, I trust what he's saying, I trust what he's doing, you know, I believe in what he does. But it's not giving up. It's like keep dripping, keep moving forward. And there are managers out there that don't like goalkeepers. You know, I had Dario Gradi when I was very, very young, and he always used to say to me, oh, we're better off with, you know, rush goalkeepers, or like, we'll get rid of goalkeepers altogether. It was a massive, like, he just never believed in goalkeeping. And I'm sure there are managers out there now that, you know, because it's such an industry, like what's happened recently, you know, is so cutthroat that they get frustrated with goalkeeping mistakes. You know, they get frustrated, oh God, you know, he's let us down or whatever. You have to keep drip feeding the information. You have to keep, you know, being part of the group, keep having your say. It's important that, you know, you can be honest with the manager in terms of, I don't believe that's right. I don't think that's right. I actually think this way. And he will respect you so much more if you stand up and go, no, I actually think this. You know, don't just nod your head in the corner and go out and work. It's like, can you do it this way? You know, can we play that kind of way? Can we build this way? Can we, I don't know, can we have a meeting with us and the centre arse because we're not quite doing this right? Or just keep having your ideas, keep filtering your ideas across to your managers and your coaches. And they respect you so much more from that. And that's how you gain that relationship. As I say, the worst thing you could possibly do is not gain a relationship, sit in a corner, do your work, and then disappear. You will never, ever progress from that.
On relationships, and you've mentioned relationships quite a lot in the pod so far, Cuts. We've spoken to other coaches about this before, but it's always good to get different perspectives, I guess. The contrast between having a relationship in a work sense and a friendship as well. So what you were saying about Emi Martinez there and the fact that he called you and, you know, it was a very sensitive situation and you dealt with that very well. And I'm guessing you have that with the managers as well. How difficult is it sometimes to manage the balance between work colleague and friend?
I don't think it is difficult, to be fair. I think because, you know, we've had heated discussions at work where, you know, where something's being said and I don't believe it. I don't think it's right. And I say heated, it becomes more of a, I honestly don't believe that's right. You know, these are my thoughts and, you know, I don't think that's right. You know, and whether it's a friendship or, you know, a working environment, I think you have to gain that relationship between the coaches because remember, you're in each other's pockets 24/7, you're constantly, but we're getting into work at like 8 o'clock and we're leaving at like 7 o'clock at night. Do you know what I mean? It's constantly working together, and you've got to have that kind of bond together. That's why you see a lot of coaches, staff moving to clubs, you know, as a group. But you've also got to be able to be totally honest. You know, it has to be honest, whether it might, you know, go against their thoughts, you know, but you have to be able to be honest and tell them what you're thinking. Because if you don't, and something happens in the game and you go, oh God, I just wish I'd have said it. You know, there's no time for ifs, buts and maybes. You know, you have to be totally honest in what you're thinking and your thoughts. And then you discuss that, becomes a discussion point. And that's why if you've got good staff around you, you have a discussion and you sort it out. You know, I'm not always right. He's not always right. And you have a discussion and come to a solution.
Go on, Rich.
You've got to know, right, that the outfield coaches have got a lot more knowledge than you in terms of outfield work. You know, and it's so important that you listen and learn to them and bounce things off them, because their knowledge, the coaches that, but you get to the Premier League, Championship, the Premier League, these guys are that detailed that you can learn so much. If you're open to that and you're bouncing stuff off them constantly, just constantly learning all the time. It's like Craig Shakespeare, Aaron Danks, people like that. You know, you've been in the game for so long and got so many different ideas. But you're constantly learning from these kind of people, you know.
Well, that was going to be my question, was in terms of learning, the fact that you've got to the level you're at now, and goalkeeper coaching, of course, you can have an idea as to the goalkeeper that you build. You can work with the individual and try and maximise their strengths. Do you find that you get to a point where you almost see it, and it's almost you've got your idea now as to what you're building? Or is the constant evolution, like, is there another step for you in terms of your education and where you can go from a coaching perspective?
Constant evolution is constantly learning, constantly changing. Even yesterday, you know, we got Mark Naylor that works alongside me, who's brilliant. You know, the Mickey Pierce and John Flatt. We've got a coaching department now that is really, really good. We sing from the same hymn sheet, but we've got so many ideas. You know, I went to Nails put on the session yesterday and I just sat back and watched it. And just little things that he does, you know, might be things that he says, might be the way he sets up the session, might be changing how he deals with the topic. You're constantly learning, constantly developing. You never, ever, you cannot stand still. You can't. I mean, I've got ideas and thoughts, but again, I can always discuss with a goalkeeper. Like Tom Heaton, we had in, what a group we had last season in terms of like Tom Heaton, Jed Steer, Emmy. You know, so many discussions in training about, you know, philosophies and thoughts. And my philosophy is, you know, can work with any kind of goalkeeping or goalkeeper in terms of the way they work. You know, I do this, just changing tiny little things can make them so much better. You know, just in terms of the way they hold their shape. And we keep talking about the detail of biomechanics and the quickest, most effective way of transferring the body weight. How are you going to work on holding the shape for the longest amount of time without transferring, without triggering? So many details go into a session that these discussions are every day, they're constant, you know, because you can't, like I keep saying, you can't just go, these are my thoughts, these are my ideas, this is what you have to do, you know. So if, like, we had Lovre Kalinic from Croatia, that's very Eastern European in his shape, totally different to the way I work. But drip feeding little details into him to get him used to the Premier League and how quick the ball moves and how quick they hit the ball and how detailed they are. I had to change parts of his biomechanics, the way he moves, in order to transfer his body weight as quickly as we possibly could. You know, how can he get onto his leading leg quickly? How are we going to make him quicker in terms of how he transfers and pushes? How am I going to maximize his power and speed? And it's always that, you know, getting the best out of them from their style, not totally changing their style, but getting the best out of what they've got, you know. And it's always a discussion and you're always learning from that. I'd never worked with a goalkeeper from Croatia before. I'd never worked on somebody with that kind of shape. So it's through discussion and through building relationships that you make them better. You know, it's all a learning curve. And you can't, you know, like Tom Heaton is is a top, top person, you know. How can you not learn from somebody who's got that many experiences? How can you not be open to what he's done and what he's got? You'd be stupid to do that. Emi Martinez, you know, his experiences from Arsenal, the way he's worked, the coaches he's worked with, how can you not be open to what they've got and how they work? And it's just that you work together as a team in order for them to progress.
So in terms of the detail, because you've kind of given an idea there, which, I mean, in theory, it's, and I always think of it like this, that if you've got a goalkeeper stood in the middle of the goal, then the idea of how quick can you get to the top corner, for instance, let's say that there was a ball that was going in the top corner, how quick can you get there? Now, there's going to be some goalkeepers that get there very, very quickly, one step, explode, top hand, and they're getting there in a split second. Other goalkeepers, maybe a couple of steps, they go with their other hand. Do you think we'll start to see almost a right and wrong? And I'm trying to think how to ask this question, because it was one where I realized back in the day that plyometrics was big for me. I got this drill. I remember I downloaded a basketball program when I was about 16, 17. There was all sorts of different jumping exercises, speed exercises, and the improvement I saw in a quick period of time was great, but there was nothing to measure it. There was no technology to necessarily say, well, you have improved in this area, but I could just feel it. I felt it was the coiled spring. You know, yeah. I felt so explosive. Yeah. I remember going back to pre-season and feeling really, really good. Do you utilize technology? That's one of the questions I've got. And when you're looking at it like that, is it one where you'll look at a goalkeeper and it's those tiny details where you'll just try and tweak something, maybe give them something in their training program that can make them a little bit quicker? And do you have objective markers? This is the other question I wanted to ask. Do you have like something where you can say their power output at the moment is X, we want to improve it, we're going to measure again in 6 weeks, we're going to do this, that, the other, we're going to change you technically, change some of your training regimes, and we're going to measure you again?
Our strength and conditioning coaches, sports science, are very, very, very good. And what we have at the football club now is one of the best in the country, you know, in terms of the gym and the way we work, and the team behind the team are so detailed that we have discussions, and we do have, you know, guides of scores of what their single leg jumping, double leg jumping, their power outputs. We have all those details, and I kind of, you know, leave it to them a little bit in terms of how they're developing that way. So I'll have discussions with Ollie Stevenson, who's a head of sports science, strength and conditioning, and he's that driven. I know I can leave it to him, because he's driven into making them more athletic, more agile, more powerful. So I kind of leave it to him. I know what he's doing, but I leave it to him. And then in terms of, so that's the gym work that they do. That's how their progression in terms of their strength and their power. And then they come to me, and then I've got, you know, I can see, I don't know, it's just from years of working in that kind of detail, how they're not maximizing their power. I'm constantly looking back on training. We've got four cameras around my goalkeeping area. I can see if they're triggered. I can see if their body weight's not getting onto the leading leg quick enough. I can see all those little details to why I think they're not powering through the back of the ball quick enough. And that's, we keep going back to learning environments. They want you to put it right for them, you know? And especially with the young goalkeepers now, they're like, they're so driven to improve that they'll huddle. We'll go, have you used huddle before? You know, when the platform where you're training, every training session is put to huddle, they can watch it back and they will send clips to me and go, what do you think about that? You know, and we can go into minute detail about, you know, you're triggering your body weight, not getting onto this, you're not doing that. And it's, and then they can then put that into train over the next few days or weeks, and then we can work on that together. You know, but there's always a reason why you're not powering through the back of the ball, you're not getting onto the leading leg quick enough. And it's mainly through triggers, it's mainly through body weight, it's mainly through speed. There's loads and loads of little things that go into a reason why something's not happening. There may be sweeping instead of transferring onto the leading leg, but loads of little details, you know, why they're not been maximizing what they've got. Emi has always bought his leading arm, won't elongate his leading arm enough. So we're working on, you know, your hand is what's powering you through the back of the ball. If you bring that in and start to rotate, you're going to fall downwards. you know, trying to, he's so powerful and so quick, but he's not maximizing what he's got. And, you know, we were talking about him being one of the top goalkeepers in Europe and in the world. He's got so much more to come. We've got so much more to work on. It's like he will be the best. He will be up there with the best because we've still got so much to work on. He's really a 29-year-old, 23, 24-year-old in terms of his game-playing experience. You know, he's had one season, really, you know, where he's played constant games. He played the whole of the Premier League and he's gone into the Copa America. Now we've got to make him consistent over years, you know, and that's through detail, you know, consistent with his detail, consistent with his shape, doing the right things at the right time, training the brain so it knows exactly what's doing at all times. Simple as that.
I actually want to come back to detail because there's a question I really want to ask you about that. But while we're on Emi Martinez, loves a celebration after a save, by the way, which I love to see. He's probably the most celebratory goalkeeper, I think, in the Premier League. Tim Krul up there too, but Emi loves a celebration after a save. And the move from Arsenal, I know that you touched on this on the Foz podcast, on the Fozcast, and it was talked about at the time just in the sense that people were surprised he'd gone to Aston Villa from Arsenal. But can I ask you just to not break down everything that went around that move, but how it actually came about? How was it that Emi Martinez became an Aston Villa goalkeeper? Because at the time, he obviously had made that leap into the first team at Arsenal. Yes, Bernd Leno was due to be coming back at the start of the following season, but he just won the FA Cup. So how did it come about?
Well, firstly, he's so driven to be the best he possibly can be. He was like, I have to be a number one now. He was 28 years of age. He had to be a number one. And if he wasn't given the guarantees of being that number one, then he was never going to stay. You know, how much he loved Arsenal and you know, grew up with Arsenal. He had to play. From then on, he was like, he'd been part of winning teams, you know, winning the FA Cup, Charity Shield, you know, he'd won games and he wanted to continue playing in order to be, you know, the best he possibly could. And he had to get out of that stage. Now, for me, he was the perfect goalkeeper, the perfect fit for me in the way he works. He's got a South American power, agility, speed with an English shape about him, which is like he's quick and athletic and he's got his side volleys, his left and right foot. He's flamboyant, but he also holds consistent with his shape. He holds a typically English shape in terms of where he keeps his hands and he doesn't trigger a lot. He's very consistent with what he does around the goal, holds his shape for the longest amount of time. So when I'm seeing that, I'm thinking, perfect for me. He sets tempos. He's great on the ball. He can see a pass. He's driven, which was a big thing for me. He's driven to improve. He's driven to win. He's driven to be the best. But his shape and his style, I knew I could make him better. I knew I could work with him because it's similar to the way I work. And in terms of then getting him in the building was a long process. We've got a very, very good sporting director that obviously we were going to buy a goalkeeper that came to me with a list of goalkeepers. And he deals a lot with stats. So he came to me with a list of goalkeepers with a load of stats on the best goalies throughout Europe. You know, they do this, they keep this many clean sheets, you know, passing percentage. But then I talked to him about my style and what I'm looking for in a goalkeeper and how I want the goalkeeper to look. We had long discussions. And that's how important it is to have an open sporting director that listens to you, you know, and you listen to him and be part of the team in terms of the next goalkeeper that's coming in. Because if you've got a sporting director, no, I want this goalkeeper because his stats are this, then maybe not going to fit in with your work ethic and your mindset. So it has to be somebody that, you know, who's going to work, who fits in perfectly. So luckily, you know, we had that relationship straight away. Then it's sitting down with the agents, discussing with the agents on terms of how I'm going to make him better, my thoughts, you know, and how he's going to improve over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And then leave it to that side of it to discuss the finances. But it was a long, drawn few months, I know that.
And you said that, can he be the best? That's what he wants to be. Do you believe that he can be the best?
Yeah, he's so driven. It's like his locker and his changing room, we've got lots of different things that he has to tick off. So he has to keep this many clean sheets. His passing percentage has to be this. He has to save this amount of penalties. He's always got things to tick off. So as soon as he gets in the morning, opens his locker, he's got these things that he has to tick, you know, in order to be the best in the world. Last season, he ticked every single one. And this season, we've improved that. We've given him more things to be able to get his teeth into, ones that we're going to make him better. You know, we've got to keep improving year in, year out. So if we keep giving him these parameters, you know, keep improving him, he's so driven to be the best. And like I said before, he drives himself. You just have to guide him in the right directions. You have to just make sure he's, you know, all these little details are ticked. But if you've got a goalkeeper that's that driven, and you talk about his celebrations, you'd never want to take that away from him because he's confident. And I always want my goalkeeper to say, be confident to the point of arrogance. Don't be arrogant, but you can be confident to the point of arrogance where you're like, come on, man. You know, like, come and beat me. You're not going to score. We saw in the Copa America against Colombia, he was like talking to the opposition, getting in their heads. You're not beating me. I'm going to save it. And that's what you'd want your goalkeeper to be, rather the other way around and going, oh, I'm not sure about this. You know, and even if you're painting your face on and going, like, I don't think I'm going to save it, but I'm going to show to people that it looks like I'm going to, you know, that kind of, you know, confidence, that kind of persona. And I'm always talking about him, you know, going through a bit of a rocky spell at the minute, but now it's how you conduct yourself. It's your presence now, rather than, you know, a couple of shots saved. Well, how are you going to affect what's going on in front of you? How are you going to affect the people in front of you? First of all, you make sure you're right in terms of your body language and how you conduct yourself and how you're trying to improve people. You know, you're trying to coach people in front of you. You're trying to help them. You're trying to demand excellence from them. And then it's like being on the front foot, showing that you're still confident, you're still energized, you're still driven. Because the easiest thing to do when you're losing games is step backwards. You know, play safe, get in your comfort zone. We're losing games, don't want to concede another goal. The best goal is step forward. They constantly step forward. They're constantly showing that confidence, that bordering arrogance, that, you know, like determination, that still desire. And you can show it with body language. And I'm dealing with the young goalkeepers at the football club and trying to educate them on body language, you know, presence. Coming in, if you can come into your first team environment at 17, 18 and have a presence, communicate, you know, drive people in front of you, it's a massive thing, you know. And we've seen with Emi now, you know, trying to get him to keep stepping forward, to show, you know, he's still confident, he's still stepping forward and not stepping backwards.
So interesting. I mean, I've got a couple more questions and I'm sure Matt has one or two more as well. And actually, Matt, before this, you don't know this, Cuts, but before this podcast, Matt actually sent me a small bit of video footage, about 7 or 8 minutes worth, I think it was, wasn't it, Matt?
It was, yes. Yes, it was, mate.
It was. It was you coming off the bench for Aston Villa, 4-0 up. So I did watch the entire 7 minutes. Very interesting.
I think I kicked it out of play my very first
game. Yeah. So do you know what? My question was going to be, so the game itself, you came on and I think the commentator, like, I think he jinxed you because he said, oh, you know, it should be a nice sort of gentle introduction. The ball's come back to you. You've got to take a touch. Didn't quite get the touch how you would have wanted it to have been. But no, in fairness, you were fine. But it did interest me just seeing you, obviously, what you know now. In terms of goalkeeping and knowing the goalkeeper you were. And I'm asking this also partly because I look at myself when I played and it's so interesting now when I watch goals back that at the time I didn't even question. But now when I look at them, there was recently actually I was looking at some of the footage from, I think it was the 07-08 season, and genuinely 20-30% of the goals I'm thinking I was at fault. Whereas at the time I couldn't remember being at fault, which I guess is partly where goalkeeping has come on in the way that it has, and it's obviously that much more scrutinized now, I guess. But you looking at yourself, the goalkeeper, and you knowing what you know now as a coach, where was your game at back then compared to where goalkeeping is now?
See, I'm total opposite to you. I was the opposite. So I think I should have saved everything. And that's really where the psychological side comes in. That's where the, you know, I had nobody to say, yeah, but this, if we do this and do that, you know, I was always on the negative side. I was always there. God, I should have done better, you know, and I should have done this and I could have done that. And I had nobody really to tell me any different. You know, I was always on the I always felt the pressure. I always felt like I was under pressure constantly. Never really enjoyed playing. I always felt like, I was technically very good. You know, I held a really good shape. My hands were very good. I thought I was good on all, technically, tactically, I thought I was good. Psychologically, nowhere near it. Nowhere near it. And that's how goalkeeping coaching has changed now. Because as we've spoke about for a long time on this, the psychological side of goalkeeping is absolutely huge. It's massive, you know, and you can have a goalkeeper that's technically and tactically very good, you know, but it's not strong enough psychologically, it's not educated psychologically on how to deal with that, how to deal with things that have gone wrong, you know, adversity. Because you're getting adversity in games constantly. And if you can educate goalkeepers from a young age on how to deal with adversity, how to play without pressure, or you know, you're always going to play with pressure, but how to deal with that pressure, and they can deal with it and they can move forward and keep moving forward, then you're winning. Because you can have so many good young goalkeepers, you know, and if you can give them the knowledge and be there for them and making sure they know you've got them, you know, you're there with them. It's not just them on their own. You're there with them. You're part of it. You're part of their progression, part of their development, and you understand it and you know it, you know. And this is, I've played at every level, you know, very briefly, obviously, in the Premier League, but every level from non-league all the way up to Premier League. I've had the best coaches, I've had bad coaches, I've had good coaches. All that I've learned now, you know, I'm taking with me into my own journey, you know, and how I deal with people. And we come back to relationships. You're dealing with, like, so much. We get to the Premier League now and it's so much pressure. Everything's scrutinised. Every last little detail is scrutinised. If they know you've got them, and we're working on it together, it's such a massive thing. It's huge. So, yeah, it's part of from my development. You know, I retired with a back injury at 29, but if I'd have had more help psychologically, if I'd have known then what I know now, I would 100% have played more. You know, I'd have definitely have kicked on better. I'd have kicked on more. I'd have played more games. But that's taught me now to be the person I am. You know, I've learned from that. And I'm the person I am now because of that. So my love for coaching is born from what I went through, my journey, my experiences.
Well, Lee Jenkins is back tracking again, and Elliott's behind him once more, flicks it over the top, and this time Cutler got a touch, and Cutler is giving Lee Jenkins a piece of his mind.
Feels like under three lifetimes in this game so far.
You actually played, just to very quickly touch on your playing career as well, there was that one game that you played for Aston Villa at Middlesbrough. There was also a massive game you played in for Swansea. So you were in that game, right, on the final day of the season for them to stay in the Football League, 2003. I was watching the highlights of that. You made an incredible stop from a free kick in that game.
Yeah, it was such a huge, huge game. You know, I remember going on loan from Stoke. I wasn't playing. I can't remember who they bought in, though. But they bought, I think it might have been Mark Crossley. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go out on loan, then I'm going to play some games. And I went to Swansea, and Swansea's, you know what Swansea fans are like? It's, they're a massive club and the fans are so passionate. And we were bottom of the league at the time, and it was the pressure of keeping Swansea in the league, because we all knew if they got relegated, the club would have been non-existent. It would have gone under. The pressure of us winning, especially the last game against Hull, was huge. You know, we had to win that game no matter what, as that club would have gone and would be non-existent. So I really enjoy playing for Swansea, you know, the people, the passion. But yeah, that last game was a huge, huge game. And it was one I always remember, because you know, the significance of it, you know, the importance of winning that game was huge.
We'll very quickly touch on Stoke as well, because I thought it was interesting that you played there, obviously went up with them through the playoffs. But at the time, considering they were a third tier side, when you looked at the squad that you were a part of, you had the three Icelandic lads. You had a guy from Belarus, Yanni Viander, of course, who's now at Brentford, Finnish. You had a Belgian and a Guinean. Such a multicultural side for a third-tier side.
That Exactly right. And you didn't have that many foreign players at the time. You know, there wasn't, you didn't really get that many teams with as many foreign players. So it was an Icelandic manager, an Icelandic owner. But what they bought was something a little bit different. And I think it made it a little bit more difficult because the third tier at the time, obviously, we're talking about aggression, you know, front foot. And we bought players in like Peter Hoekstra, who was a left winger, Dutch left winger. What a player. And he could even perform in the third tier when he was like playing on bad pitches, muddy pitches. And he was like, he shone every game. We had a Belarusian centre half and just shoot ahead and kick everything. We had Icelandic players with a little bit of flair, something about them. So it was like, it was tough because you go into every game and it's like, you know what it's like at that level. But we managed to get some quality out of it, you know, with some quality players.
Right, Rich, I've got one more before you get to your final bits, okay? It's just one more question that I wanted to ask because the word detail has come up a lot in this podcast. It came up a lot in the Fozcast as well.
Yeah.
And you spoke a lot about there's always something you can do with every goal. And Ben spoke about that optimal position. Rich speaks about the optimal position quite a lot in the Between the Sticks podcast that we do. And I guess sometimes when we do the pod, I'm thinking, are we overanalyzing too much? How long can this podcast keep going on for? Because how much can we keep talking about a specific save or goal that was conceded? So I just want to put this to you about over-analysis. So I know that you guys always say there's just something you can do with every single goal, but I look at the goal scored by Harvey Barnes last week for Leicester City at Leeds. Yeah. Top bins. In my opinion, there's absolutely no chance any goalkeeper on the planet is ever saving that. Or is there, with the right training and getting that optimal position right and just changing things week to week, the chance that one goalkeeper could have saved that? So is there an over-analysis or is there always something which can be done?
There's 100% over-analysis. You can over-analyse and that's why you've got to understand how much you talk to a goalkeeper, how much you want to put in a goalkeeper's head. You know, it's quite easy to scramble them. So say if we're doing a debrief on a goal and it's got one where he'll say, I've got no chance, but I can see something. I might not go, well, he should have done this or could have done this or could have done that. I'll just see it, recognise it, write it, work on training without even knowing about it because you're 100% right. What you don't want to do is make a goalie robotic. You don't want to make them robotic. This is what we do and how we do it. Have to do it this way. Your hands have to be there. It has to be this and structured to a point where they get robotic. Can't do that. What you have to do is change them in little details where you can see something, you see a goal. It might be that, you know, he's triggered slightly or he stepped backwards or he's got too wide. And that's something I'd go, look how wide you are there. You know, like you might have saved it if you'd have done this and that. I might then just go, right, okay, I'm noting it. I'm watching it in training. I'm assessing it in training without him even knowing about it because it's too much. It's too much coaching. It's too much detail. On a Friday, say if it's a match day minus one, I try and do very little coaching or match day minus two, even when we're putting on match specific scenarios to recreate the opposition. I might not coach as much. It might be just positional rather than technical. So the key is then to not overcoach or fill his head with too much information when you're getting closer to the game. You know, it might be just tiny little things that we're working on. Whereas, say, match day plus one, plus two as part of their recovery, it might be that we're working on a bit more in-depth detail. And as we get closer to the game, more detailed on the opposition and him technically or tactically within that opposition scenario. But not too much. You don't want to scramble him. You want to free him up. We do a lot of work on bodies in front. Because if you see most goals that have gone in are going through bodies, round bodies, over bodies. And we like to recreate what he can see or what he can't see to maximise his hand-eye and his the detail of not... And how he's going to basically... Giving him a problem. So you give him a problem. You know on Saturday, it's not just going to be a shot where you can see the ball all the way in. How is he going to solve the problem of these bodies in front and his position in relation to the ball? So as I say, I've gone off tangent a little bit here, but in terms of overcoaching, You can definitely do that. You can definitely overcoach. You can definitely scramble. Too much information. And when you're talking about developing young goalkeepers, that can be exactly the same. So it's like, it's kind of telling them, right, okay, you're going to go through this conscious phase of thinking. Going to go through it. So don't worry about that. But only give them like two or three or even 2 points to work on per session. Today, you're going to work on this. This is all going to work. Don't worry about anything else. You're going to just make sure they're going to try and change this slightly, or they're going to try and work on this slightly. Don't overcoach. Don't scramble.
It's probably quite a nice place to lead this pod, because for me, that comes back to the very thing we spoke about at the start, where goalkeeper coaching isn't black and white. A lot of it is the relationship side of things. And I'm guessing a massive part is to know when they're ready to take on information. So, for instance, if they've had a tough few weeks and, you know, actually you just want to simplify things to allow them to get back to a place, whereas they might be in another headspace where actually things are going great, and if anything they want to kick on and they want to take on more and more, and you might feel that you can overload them a little bit more.
Yeah, we had a similar situation when we played West Ham last week. Two goals went in the bottom corner, and I felt that he overcovered slightly. I think I felt that he had half a step too much, and he overcovered near. And I'm looking from up above, from right high up in the top of the stand, the camera, and I can see his position. But I'm not looking from his eyes. I can't see what he can see. So I'm saying, I'm thinking you're overcovered. He's going, no. And I'm going, well, if I see you there, I think you've gone hot. No, I don't think so. And it's like, okay, well, I'm actually going off you, because you can see and you're in that scenario and I am not. So I'm going from a camera angle, you're going from your eyes and how you feel and your mindset at that time. And that's when that discussion happens, because I could quite easily go into that room and go, you've overcovered, what are you doing? Change it, what are you doing? I don't know what he's seeing or what he's thinking at the time. So that's where that discussion has to be, you know, a two-way thing. It can't be, you know, you've done this wrong, you've got to change it. It's got to be that I've done it for this reason. I thought he was going to cut in. I thought he was going to reverse it. So I've opened at the far end because, you know, I think I can save it when he whips it around on, because he's cutting from, he's right-footed. It was Johnson, I think, right back, cutting to his left foot, and he thought he was going to reverse it down to his left. So he's thinking, right, okay, if he whips into that far corner with his left foot, I'm going to save it. So it's just half a step. It was half a step overcovered. But it's his mindset. It's what he's thinking. He's done it for the right reasons. So we recreated that scenario in training and said, right, okay, if it happens again, what would you do? I'd probably do the same thing again, because, you know, I've got this body in front of me and that body in front of me, and he's rotated in front of me there. So that's why I've done it. Okay, well, that's what you do then. That's what, you know, it's like you have to recreate and relearn. And if it's still the same scenario, then that's what he does. You know, he has to be 100% comfortable in what you're doing.
What I love about that as well is that it can also be very easy for a goalkeeper to continually make changes. You know, because when a goal goes in, naturally, you're always going to think, oh, what could I do? But sometimes, actually, you might, like you said there, do you know what, recreate it. If you're going to do the same thing again, that's absolutely fine, because it's not black and white. We haven't got the technology yet to say that, scientifically speaking, your positioning should be this, according to the thousand.
If he gets beat continuously in the bottom corner, right, there's an issue. There's an issue there. It's something that needs changing. If it's a one-off, right, and the balls did go into the bottom corner, right into the bottom corner, right, if it's a one-off, then he's done it. He's got his position in relation to that ball from what he thought at that time was the right thing to do, right? But if that then becomes an issue where the same goals are going in, where he's getting beaten to bottom corners, then something needs changing. So you reassess it again and go, hang on a sec. This is now become an issue. It's now a problem because it's constantly going in. So then we need to reevaluate. And that's where the relationship comes in, where you go, hang on a sec, now is the time where we need to change it, because you can't keep, the couple can't keep beating you from that position. So, you know, that's when the relationship comes in and go, we have to change it. You know, we have to change something. We can't keep getting beat like that. But again, from that game and from that scenario, very rarely gets beaten to bottom corners. Very powerful, very quick, very athletic, and clever in terms of positions he takes up in relation to the ball or in relation to what he can see of the ball. And then you've got players in front of you that have got to do better. You know, too much rotation, too much moving out of the way of the ball, nobody getting down the line of the ball, nobody protecting any side of the goal at all. And that's where we have to do better as a group, not just as a single goalkeeper or a single person.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And I think that I often see it, or I'll speak to goalkeepers where they're like, oh, had I done this, I would have saved it. And often that's true. You know, had they done something different. But I suppose we go back to probability. And actually, a lot of the time, and what you've just said there, look, is that something that is irregular? Is it a problem? Then at that point, deal with it. If it's not, just be careful not to learn the wrong lessons, I guess would be the key point. But look, cuts, we could do this all day. We could talk goalkeeping. We've gone through glove cuts, latex, Vaseline on gloves. We've gone deep into the psychological side. There's so much more, again, we could go into. I'm sure there will be a part two at some point. I'm glad there's a part one, though, because we've been waiting a long time for the part one. But look, the final question, I'm sure you know what the final question is. We asked to all of our guests. Neil Cutler, what has goalkeeping given you?
I think it's definitely made me the person I am in terms of, you know, how I am, how I treat people, how I deal with people. You know, growing up in football, the changes that I've had, the experiences that I've had has made me evaluate me as a person constantly. You know, I'm constantly evaluating how I treat people, how I deal with people, how I am around people. Because I think you have, in football, you're constantly self-assessing, constantly. And I think it's just made me become the person I am in terms of how I deal with people, how I speak to people, my relationships with people. And like I say, it's molded me as a person. I think it can go deep into it, but definitely a big believer in karma and a big believer in treating people the right way and doing things the right way. And football has allowed me to be that, you know, through the experiences of good, bad and indifferent, you know, just, it's just molded me into a person where, you know, becoming a good person and having the right values and having the right beliefs is key for me. And I think football has helped me become that.
Neil Cutler, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Looked to be running into a cul-de-sac, but he has worked the ball to O'Connor. This now is a chance for Owusu to cross. There are men in the middle, but Cannon climbs high. Blocked on the line by Cutler somehow. Closest Brentford have come all day.
Well, this is about the best delivery they've produced as well. It's a fantastic ball in by Owusu. Great header by McCammon. I thought it was in. He's done well to get anything on that and be able to get it second time round.
Especially for a goalkeeper who's been largely a spectator all day.
He took the words out of my mouth. He had nothing to do in the first half. He's had an occasional save to make in the second and a bit of involvement. That's a very, very good stop.
So, Richard, that was Neil Cutler. And yet again, with another of our goalkeeping guests, I feel like we could have spoken for a good 3 hours there. And I feel like he could have spoken for 3 hours too.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think if anything, it was probably us cutting the conversation short a little bit, because certainly it's a great thing about Cuts. Obviously, I've got to know him a lot over the past few years. Known him for obviously a long time since playing against him, etc. But he is so, and he keeps using the word detail. And I think that comes across even in the way in which he speaks, in that he's not one to skirt around the edges of a subject. He really does want to go that little bit further. And it just made me smile, the fact that we started talking about gloves and 10 minutes later, we're still talking about gloves and we're getting so specific about them. And I guess that, to an extent, sums up the conversation for me, in that everything we spoke about, it wasn't just giving maybe some of the generic remarks you might hear. It was just going that little bit further and exploring it that little bit more.
And you know what? I think that we're constantly evaluating the podcast, constantly self-assessing, which ties nicely into the pod, because we spoke a lot about that, didn't we, in the continual, never-ending improvement. But when we do the podcast and you listen back to it and you edit it, and when we do the Between the Sticks as well, I'm always thinking, is this good enough? Or can we do something to make this better? Can we chuck in another franchise? Can we jazz it up? Can we make it more colourful? And sometimes just having three people around a table or over Zoom just talking and there not being anything else, and specifically when it's a subject like Neil Cutler, just saying, right, here's a quick question, now you talk for half an hour, that's actually fine. That suffices, it works, because this podcast is testament to that.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think I mean, how many times, and people listening in, I'm sure everyone's had this, where you'd be having a conversation with someone and at the end thinking, God, if only that were recorded. Like, I've got no doubt people would get value out of that. And that's essentially, I guess, what we're trying to do here, in that just having a general chat with the likes of Anil Cutler, like, it's the years of experience he's got, obviously not only playing, but now coaching, from all the coaches he's worked with, managers he's worked with, and he's now at the level he is. I think where I've got no doubt there'll be a lot of young coaches listening to this, he is, and I use him a lot as a reference, he really is a role model to a lot of young coaches out there that really want to progress in the game, and that he's very much started, you know, at Walsall, wasn't on a huge salary by any means at that point, and he's gradually worked his way up, obviously been at several clubs, now finds himself where he is, and he's doing incredibly well for himself. And of course, at time of recording, a little bit of upheaval in terms of Aston Villa, but the club have made it very well known that they want him to stay. That's how highly they value him, how much they've seen what he's done behind the scenes alongside Dean Smith, but also independently. So, no, massive credit to him, and I've got no doubt that a lot of people listening in will have taken loads of value from that.
I was scribbling notes as we were talking to Cut, so I'm going to read some of them out to you now, just to get your reaction on some of the stuff that he spoke about. We already did react in the podcast, but it's nice to just evaluate them now. Good glove chat, like you said. I thought it was interesting that he said he puts his gloves on when he trains because he wants to feel part of training, and more so, he takes them off when he's speaking with other coaches as part of those match-specific setups. And the reason he did that was to not distinguish the goalkeeper element. So he wasn't, oh, there, you know, there's the goalkeeper guy talking about goalkeepers. It was actually, he's part of the team.
Yeah, look, I think goalkeeper coaches, everyone reacts a little bit differently. But I think for him, it comes back to, and I keep using that word detail, it comes back to the details. You know, it's a tiny, tiny thing. But again, it just might shift the perception of somebody that's looking in. So I think to have an awareness of something like that, this is one of those. And again, it's not going to make or break. It's not a big deal. But at the same time, it's just one of those small things that he's obviously thought about, and in thinking about it, has made a decision that moving forward, I will do this. I will have my gloves on at this time, and I'll have them off at this time. And that might be for him personally, in terms of changing his mindset as to where he is in that moment, or it might be external. It might be one where people are looking and they see him in a certain way. So again, it's the next level. You know, that's probably what I link it back to, in that it's not a unconscious movement, unconscious decision. It is something that he has thought about, and there is a reason behind it.
And the info on Emi Martinez was great too, and the fact that when he was looking at him, recruiting him to an extent, he said, I knew I could make him a better goalkeeper. I could see something in him. And the fact that he has checkboxes on his locker that he has to tick off to ensure that he is the best, Emi Martinez. And the psychological stuff that we spoke about at length too, when he comes in at half time and he said, at times Emi will come in and he's thinking about the goals he's conceded and saying, oh, I should have done better. No, park that. We're not discussing that now. We've got a second half to play. Forget about that. We'll talk about that at a later date.
Yeah, I think for me, it really backed up my belief that when you're recruiting a goalkeeper, whatever level it might be, of course, there are certain stats out there that you can look at and it can help back up a decision. But I think so much of it is exactly what he's explained, where top goalkeeper coaches, top people in the profession will get a feeling. They will see a goalkeeper and they'll get a feeling as to whether they're going to fit into the model in which the goalkeeper coach works. So, for instance, Neil Cutler makes it very clear that his high-intensity training, the way in which the goalkeeper needs to play for Aston Villa, will be slightly different to other teams. The fact that he's obviously learned enough about him as a person, personality, to know that, again, that personality will come in and fit. And I just think that there's so much to it. And again, the detail he's gone in terms of how Emi is, the reasons they did decide to go for him over a lot of others. And if you remember at the time, as much as now we look at it and think, God, fantastic business. You know, Arsenal arguably would have loved to have kept him. Looking at how things have played out, they've gone and spent a lot more on another goalkeeper now. So I guess when you look at it on that front, oh, you know, made absolute sense. But remember at the time, that amount of money for Emi Martinez, it did raise a few eyebrows, given that at the time, he'd only played a handful of games for Arsenal, hadn't played that many games in the Premier League. Yes, they were very, very good games, but to suddenly go from a relative unknown, I think that's fair to say, to suddenly being worth, what, 20-odd million, it was a big fee to pay at the time, but they were so certain, and he was so certain that he was the right person to come in and do it. And I think it's safe to say that he's been proven more than correct.
And lastly, just to finish on one really good quote, I thought sums up what it is to be a goalkeeper coach. where he said, my job is to get Jed Steer in as number one, and my job is to keep Emi Martinez as number one. Mm. And that is essentially one of the hardest things to do as a goalkeeper coach. Yeah. That's where you've got to get that balancing act.
Yeah, I think, and again, we went into real detail on this, and I'm glad that we did, because as much as you could look at goalkeeper coaching and just see it as kicking balls at keepers, you know, putting on great sessions, it's not. The relationship side of it is so big, and to keep the players happy is a massive thing. The relationship between him and the manager, I love that we went into such detail on that, because again, that is so, so important. But he kept using the word as well, environment. What is the environment you're creating? And I think if you create the right environment, which doesn't just happen overnight, that takes time, that's levels of excellence and making sure that everybody's buying in to what you're doing, you can then create a system like he has, where you've got a two that pushes a one that is doing everything to keep the two out, a three that's no doubt developing. They've got a young goalkeeper there who's very, very good, Vilrami, who's an excellent young keeper, who again is developing at a quick rate. So naturally, more goalkeepers that are entering that environment, they're only going to improve. You're going to have a team that are going to, more often than not, have a goalkeeper that is outstanding year after year. So look, you don't want to say he's nailed it, and you know, I'm sure if I said that, it could come back and bite him. But I just think the processes he's put in place, the environment that he's now created, I do think it's a great model and a great lesson. Again, whether at professional level or amateur level, doesn't really matter. I think so much of it comes down to that. Keep your focus on the process, on the environment. And again, I think the results certainly speak for themselves.
Okay, Richard, I think that is about that. We do reference as well the Fozcast quite a bit in that podcast. Just to clarify, we love the Fozcast. We were joking about the fact that he'd done it first. We think that it's great. And the conversation with him and Boaz Myhill, if you haven't listened to it already, which I'm guessing you probably have, considering the listens or the views that he gets on YouTube and the people that listen to this podcast, I imagine there's some crossover there. So a brilliant podcast. Go and listen to that too. And maybe, Richard, maybe one day you'll be on it. Who knows?
You never know. You never know. One day.
Richard, thank you.
Matthew, thank you.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Keepers
away!
And Cutler gathers the ball, and that will be just about that.